Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. New York Times food writer Kim Severson is a big believer in kitchen wisdom. Not so long ago, she was down on her luck and on the verge of losing everything. She turned to the stovetop and to some celebrated women chefs who Severson says saved her life. She tells that story in a remarkable new memoir. This hour On Point, celebrated food writer Kim Severson turns the tables on herself. You can join the conversation. What is it about a bubbling pot on the stove or the smell of fresh dill that can soothe the senses and renew the spirit? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll hear from famed culinary pioneer Alice Waters. Joining me now from New York City is Kim Severson. She's food writer for the New York Times and a four-time winner of the James Beard Award for Food Writing. Her new memoir is Spoon-Fed, How Eight Cooks Saved My Life. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kim Severson, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Oh, it's nice to be here, Jane. How are you?
Fine, thanks. I enjoyed your book. There are a lot of big themes in it centered around eight women cooks who taught you some important lessons. What do you think it is about women and food?
Well, I'm no psychiatrist, but I imagine there's a mother connection here somewhere. And I know for me, I came from a big family of five kids, and my mom's kitchen was really her office. You know, she packed our lunches, and we had dinner every night, breakfast in the morning. So for me, getting close to my mom and, you know, getting my share of the attention meant being in the kitchen. So I think some of it starts there. But I think there's just such a nurturing thing about feeding someone and cooking for someone. And that seems maternal, although that's not to say there are a lot of dads who I know now who have deep bonds with their sons and daughters over cooking.
Beyond the nurturing aspect of cooking, how do you describe the essence of a good cook?
I think it's a kind of a dance. I think, and it's in some ways, it's kind of like writing. You want to really know your audience and know what might make them happy at any given time. I think cooking, certainly it's pleasurable for the cook, but for me, the real joy is feeding someone, is watching them when they eat. And, you know, I'm not a master chef by any means. I'm a pretty good home cook, and I enjoy it a lot. I don't spend inordinate amounts of time creating elaborate meals unless I'm testing something for work. But I find just the simple act of making somebody something good and giving it to them and sitting down and talking to them while you eat together is really, really where the power is in cooking for someone.
You've been a food writer for the New York Times since 2004. I wish you'd tell us how you got into food writing in the first place.
Well, it was kind of a complete accident in a lot of ways. I was in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'd moved up there. I'd been like a lot of post-Watergate babies we all thought would go to journalism school and save the world, and I was going from small paper to small paper and had covered cops and courts and hard news and that kind of thing. And I was working for a paper that was owned by the same chain that owned the Anchorage Daily News, and I thought I would take a chance and go to Alaska and try to become a little bit more of a feature writer and broaden out a little bit. And I'd always been into food. I'd, you know, worked my way through college waiting tables and short order cooking and making pizza at a chain restaurant and that sort of thing. And so I liked food a lot, and I'd cooked a lot. But when I got there, they had a need for a restaurant critic at the Anchorage Daily News. And I was to make this joke that being the restaurant critic in Anchorage, Alaska is a little like being the best ballerina in Lubbock, Texas. And I made the mistake of saying that once to a group of people, and afterwards a woman came up and said, you know, I was the prima ballerina in Lubbock, and I felt terrible about it. But, you know, so I just started writing restaurant reviews in Anchorage, and Anchorage is a town of 360-some thousand people, and A lot of it's got a better culinary profile than you might think. There's certainly a lot of great raw ingredients, the king crab and the scallops, and the growing season is short and intense. There's a pretty big Korean community there from there's army bases, and from the Korean War, their families came over.
And so many small villages where you ate whale meat and smoked salmon
right.
of all types.
There's also that. And, you know, I didn't grow up eating whale meat. And so when I found myself at a potluck chewing it, and, you know, it's the kind of thing that gets bigger the more you chew it. And tastes like it's dipped in seal oil, tastes a little fishy. And it's just, you know, I mean, had I grown up on that, I probably would have thought it was the best whale meat ever. And it was, I choked it down and swallowed and smiled and said thank you very much and then pushed the rest around on my plate. But, you know, you want to be a polite guest in those circumstances.
Mm. Well, the story of how you made your way out of Anchorage is something that I hope we'll get to throughout the hour. But you made your way ultimately to the San Francisco Chronicle and then to New York. But the first woman you highlight in your book is Marion Cunningham, the grand dame of American cooking. Tell us her story and what her impact was on your life.
Marion Cunningham is someone probably not a household name to a lot of people, but she was really for a while America's like last great home cook. And she rewrote the Fanny Farmer cookbook. She wrote several other cookbooks too. I had a column in the San Francisco Chronicle and other places. For a while, she was James Beard's assistant. And she really became the mother confessor to a lot of people in the 80s and 90s, particularly in the 80s when the California cuisine movement was happening and when America was getting into regional food and kind of looking in its own backyard. Alice Waters, who I know is queued up for a conversation later, she was a great shoulder to cry on for Alice Waters. So I got this assignment early on, first thing out of the shoot, really, to interview her for the San Francisco Chronicle. And she was really the first person who taught me a big life lesson.
Which was?
Well, so here's the story. I had discovered in Alaska, right before I got the job at the Chronicle, that I had a pretty serious drinking problem. It's not like I just woke up one day, but, you know, after a while you realize this has got to stop. So I stopped drinking just a few months before I got the job at the San Francisco Chronicle. And, you know, I was really at a bad place, obviously. You know, I always say the big cosmic joke of my life is that I get a job writing for the San Francisco Chronicle an hour away from one of the great wine regions of the world, and I have to never have another drink of alcohol. It was something that was difficult for me to deal with in the beginning. So one of my first assignments is Marion Cunningham, and I'm feeling all insecure, and I was from Alaska, right? And here I am at the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm driving out to visit her to do this interview, and I walk in her house. We have this lovely interview and talk about all kinds of things and about her new book. And eventually we keep talking, and I tell her how terrified I am to be there and that I just didn't think I was going to be able to do it and to kind of or to cut it and that I was afraid. And she said, well, you seem pretty terrific to me, dear. So that's kind of the first, sometimes you just hear that thing you need. And then, of course, so I'm like, well, we're best friends now, right? So I tell her I also just quit drinking and that wasn't helping my situation any. And she then tells me the most remarkable story, which is that when she was about 50, she decided carrying gin bottles around in her purse wasn't a good idea. And she stopped drinking too at 50. And she went on to become James Beard's assistant and to get the contract to rewrite the Fanny Farmer cookbook and started her life in food. And it just occurred to me that any time in your life, you can start over. I mean, you can start over at any point in the day. But that idea that I was going to be okay and that I could start over any time and my life was going to probably turn out okay was a huge lesson from Marion Cunningham.
I wish you'd read from part of Spoonfed the story that you tell about Leah Chase, who was a master of Creole cooking and, my goodness, had so many contributions, made so many contributions to the social and cultural fabric of New Orleans. What was her story briefly before you read from your book?
All right. Well, Leah Chase, you know, she had a place, Dookie Chase, that Bill still has it, that was the place that anyone who was anyone had to go to in New Orleans. Ray Charles wrote it into a song, and even recently, post-Katrina, George W. Bush visited there, Clinton, other presidents. But really, it became the place for African-Americans in New Orleans to gather, but also for blacks and whites to gather in the civil rights era when those two groups were not supposed to, by law, be mingling. So she really was the center of so much in New Orleans, and of course, a center for Creole cooking, which is Leah Chase's great strength. And I went down right after Katrina. The newspaper sent me down. There's one great thing about the New York Times. It's the only paper I know of that would send a food writer down post-Katrina to write about what happened to the restaurants. Mm. So I was down there a couple, 2-3 weeks after the floods. The city was still closed, and I went and took an inventory of the city's restaurants. And just went around, and there was only one little one open making eggs. And we went by Leah Chase's, and it had been taken out about 5 feet of water. The whole neighborhood was just, it was like being in a black and white movie because the water had sapped the color and covered everything in gray. And there was a ring around her building, and the smell, I still can conjure that sort of horrible, fishy, leathery, muddy smell and rotting food. And so then I kept going back and visiting her as she moved into a FEMA trailer next to it and rebuilt the house, rebuilt the restaurant. And she taught me a lot about faith. So I could read this little section about her now.
You know, I'm gonna ask you to do that after the break because we don't have time now for the reading.
Okay.
But she taught you about faith, and she taught you to pray, which you talk about in your book quite a lot. Why is that important to you as a food critic?
And I say a lot of things in this book. I what's more embarrassing to me to say is to throw up in bathrooms or that I pray every day. The fact that I do pray every day is it's a private thing. And I find that in the food world, not a lot of people talk about it, but it really is a great source of strength for me. Although sometimes it's just as easy as, okay, here we go in the morning. And then, at the end of the night. But, the idea of something larger than me making the world go around has been it's been quite comforting and something that I learned along the way.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about great woman cooks and the life lessons we've learned around the kitchen table. Our guest is Kim Severson, food writer for The New York Times. Her new memoir is Spoon-Fed, How 8 Cooks Saved My Life. Before the break, we were talking, Kim, about one great cook, Leah Chase. You first met her, you mentioned, in a FEMA trailer outside her restaurant in New Orleans in 2006. You write about her great gumbo, her fried chicken, her red beans and rice. Read from the book what she taught you about that, about all that, and more.
All right. Few people know more about New Orleans food than Mrs. Chase. She's in her 80s now and has been given almost every culinary award this country can bestow. The big-name chefs all respect her. After all, she's the best Creole cook in America, rightly famous for fried chicken and red beans and rice and 1,000 other dishes she's been making since she was a young woman. Using her food as a jumping-off place, Mrs. Chase spent a lifetime lifting up her community. Like my mother, she came from a family with 11 children where food was at the center. And like my mother, she's a dedicated Catholic and a woman of great faith. She learned early on a basic formula that she would come to rely on in even the most trying of situations. Every day, without fail, and no matter how bad her circumstance, no matter if a child has died or flood water churned through her livelihood, she does 3 things. First, you pray, she told me. Then you work and do for others. That's it. It sounds easy, but it's not. Faith like that only counts when it's tested. That's when you find out if you really believe.
Kim Severson, how did the lessons that you write about bring you closer to your own culinary roots, to your own family, your own Italian-American cooking family, especially your mom?
Well, it's kind of funny. I really got my eyes opened a little bit. I had a lot of romantic notions about my family's cooking in Italy and, you know, like most daughters of Italian-American, with Italian-American roots, you dream of going home to the old country and of learning, I don't know what I thought I would learn when I finally got back to Italy where my grandmother was born. I was trying to track the roots of the spaghetti sauce that my mother makes and trying to figure out how it came to be this big kind of heavy, meaty basil and oregano sauce. And, you know, I'd like a lot of people had spent maddening hours trying to get my mother to give me the right recipe, you know, and she'd say, oh, just do a little of this, and then you put this in, and I'm like, wait, you put chicken thighs? Oh, well, honey, I had some, so I put them in. And, you know, it's crazy making. If you've ever tried to get a recipe from an older cook, there's just so much that you don't get. So I went back, anyway, to the part of Atalanta, to the part of Italy where my family's from, and I realized that spaghetti sauce is nowhere to be found there. And it really was the story of immigrants coming over the abundance of the American table, having all that meat in that ragu, would never have done it in Italy. The pronounced garlic and oregano, those flavors and smells of home that immigrants in America used to really underscore and emphasize their culture when they were immersed in a totally different one. But it really did make me understand much more about what it took for my mother to become the cook that she became, and how she fit into the modern American culinary, how she used the modern American culinary canon. And, you know, she was a great lover of the supermarket. She cracks up that I want to try to make my own sausage. She's like, oh, honey, there's such good sausage at the store. Just go buy some. You know, this idea, I'm coming back to, you know, this artisan, you know, agrarian life. And she worked really hard to get off that farm. So it baffles her a little.
Kim, here's a great call. Let's go to it from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Utah is on the line. Welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane, and hi, Kim. I am delighted to hear that such a book was published for many reasons. I'm a retired chaplain. I'm getting old now. But I used to tell the aides in the healthcare facility who fed very, very old people who cannot feed themselves anymore how important, how significant their job actually is. Without being fed, an old person will not survive. And I used to tell them, the significance of your work is like the Eucharist. It's like Holy Communion. If nobody feeds these people, they will die. Hmm. So that is number one. Number two, I'm delighted you have a faith life part in your book. I look forward to reading that book. With the negativity of fast food in our culture, it is so good for people to have a book like that again, to rediscover the significance of sharing a meal. Meals create community, number one. And I feel a house is no home without the perfume in the kitchen, meaning the foods. Mm. So I look forward to reading this new book, and I am delighted. I love to cook myself, and I am just grateful that such a book was written. And I am also enormously grateful for you, Kim, to share with such gutsy honesty your recovery and your new life you found.
Utah, thank you. Thank you very much. It's a nice call, Kim.
Thanks so much, really. Wow.
What are the emerging food trends that you see today? I mean, as far as cooking and being at home, do you see people, do you see families sort of going back to the table, or have we left that era, do you think?
I think it's a really thrilling time in the kitchens in America. I think everybody's really heading back there with great enthusiasm, and in a way that is real and perhaps simpler than it was when people were having, you know, they had their big granite counter, huge showplace kitchens and doing elaborate dinner parties. I think it's a much more simpler and perhaps more authentic melding of food and family life. And there are some Tuesday nights when people are going to get a rotisserie chicken and a bag of pre-cut lettuce, and that'll be dinner. But the point is people sat at home and ate it. And there still may be takeout pizza some nights, but it's not the mainstay. I think people are learning to incorporate cooking and all the convenience food in a holistic way. And particularly excited about what I see among people who are, say, in their 20s, who are really taking an interest in where food comes from and in canning and in learning how to butcher their own animals and cooking together. Somebody was telling me that they invited me up to Yale, and we've been trying to arrange this, but they're going out to a field to have a pig roast, some of the undergrads. And I was like, I remember going out to fields to have keggers when I was in college. So now the thing in college is pig roast. I think that's a terrific advancement. Mm. And a lot of it is economic. And people had to go back. The last few years have been tough. More people have gone back and started cooking. But I think it started to happen even before that.
These eight cooks that you write about in your book, Kim Severson, ranging from Marion Cunningham, who we spoke of, to Leah Chase down in New Orleans, to people like Alice Waters, who we'll speak with in just a few minutes, to Rachel Ray. These popular cooks, chefs, who are both revered and criticized for different reasons. Why do you think that is, and what are the lessons you learned, really, about that?
People are like, you know, all my kind of foodie McFoodie friends are like, I can't believe you put Rachel Ray in that book with all those lovely chefs, you know. And then I have other people who feel like, you know, Alice Waters certainly has her critics. So I guess everybody brings brings something to these folks. Rachel Ray, I think, is a really interesting person. I wrote a profile of her for the New York Times before her show and her magazine was launched, and I learned a lot from her. I think she's easy to criticize, but I also think she was an important bridge back to the kitchen for people. That idea that you could put together something decent in 30 minutes was a relief for a lot of people who I think felt, you know, they were a couple generations out of actually cooking. And, you know, the girl works hard. I'll tell you what, she's one of the hardest working people in the food business, and I was very impressed. She started just hauling her little demo carts to the Price Choppers up in Schenectady, New York, and has been working hard ever since. And she's also a very authentic person. And I think, lover or hater, she stuck with who she is, and she uses that, you know, for the success in her career. So I certainly learned from her that no matter who you think you want to be, the only way you're going to succeed is to be yourself. And it was also a good reminder that rolling up your sleeves and working hard is what's going to get you ahead in the long run.
Be your authentic self. I think that's what you wrote. No matter what people think, the lesson that you learned from her. Here's another call from Lynn in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Lynn. Welcome.
Welcome.
Hello. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Jane. Mm-hmm. Kim, appreciate it. I enjoyed the comments so far that you've made about working and praying, working for others. And I know that is sometimes hard to people think you're nuts when you say you pray every day. But I just wanted to make the comments, a couple of them. One is, my name is Lynn, but I'm not a girl. And I get
but that's
that a
okay.
lot from people. Yeah, thank you. But that was one thing that I didn't want y'all to just leave out the guys in this in all this comments, because I worked out of my home for a number of years and made the lunch boxes for my kids and made dinner. And my kids still think I'm a better cook than my wife. So
you've done your fair share of meal planning and cooking, right?
Yes. Yes. And I agree completely. Sitting down and sharing a meal is one of the best things that any family can ever do. It's been proven that it helps kids in school and social situations and everything else.
Well,
and
Lynn,
I also have been involved in the Meals on Wheels and Room in the Inn program at my church. And we always try to make the people that, the guests that come in from our Room in the Inn, I always want them to make them feel like they've been at Granny's house when they leave.
Mm.
Because they've had such good food and plenty of snacks and fellowship and friendship that they feel like, you know, oh, I wish I could do that every night. Mm. So I think food is certainly an integral part of all that, and I appreciate and look forward to being able to read your book, because I think that's food is a connector that we all have, and it goes across all kinds of generations and cultural differences, and it makes a world of difference.
Lynn, thank you. Thank you very much for your call from Nashville. It is a good point, Kim. I mean, there's something, no matter where you are, there's something soothing and calming and welcoming, really, about watching a good cook work or tasting the food, whether you're sitting in front of them or even watching on TV, I would say.
Well, it's interesting, too, that we so love to watch people cook, and it's always amazing to me, because you never get to taste the product of that, you know, and yet we're deeply invested. But I think we have such strong food memories and kind of in our heads put together how something might taste, and we really do love it. And I, you know, to the gender point, I think it's absolutely true. I this is part where some of my best friends are men and they cook, but I think it's getting to a point where you know, it's very fluid in the kitchen. My story happens to just be focusing on women, but I, you know, one of my great readers on this book was a guy who was the, you know, the main cook in his household. And I think we're really at a point where that's very fluid in terms of what the responsibilities for cooking are in households. I think that's a change that's a very welcome one.
I find it so interesting, Kim Severson, food writer for the New York Times and author of this new book, Spoon Fed, that what makes you so accessible in the book and so real is that you talk about buying locally grown produce and meat at the Green Market and a food co-op in New York in the city. You eat at some of the world's best restaurants, but you also whip up a potato chip dip with sour cream and Lipton's dried onion soup. I mean, you sort of run the gamut. How do you describe your own palate? How do you describe your own tastes?
Oh, man, I can't believe you just fessed up about the California dip. Alice Waters is going to kill me when she comes
on. It's out.
Yeah, thanks, man. There's so many things that I like just because I remember things about why I like them. And that onion soup dip really does. It reminds me of kind of the first unchaperoned parties I got to have in my parents' basement. It reminds me of football season. And, you know, and then it's also just, even though it's got that little kind of onion chemically taste, there's that cool whipped cream and then the crispy, salty chip. It's just kind of a good, you know, just tastes good. So I think I do have a few things that I really like that are kind of craptastic foods. But I also like other things that are, you know, once you get a little education, you start to understand where something comes from or what makes one thing better than the other. And you get a little education, it really enhances what you eat. So, you know, I suppose I come from a fairly middle-class Midwest kind of background, so some of those food memories are strong for me. But also, once you've had amazing chefs cook really brilliant food grown by people who care about it, that changes you, changes what you like.
Because we'll be speaking with Alice Waters after our next break here, Kim Severson, you wrote about her in the book. Tell us your experience with her and what you learned from Alice Waters, the famous Alice Waters.
All right, the famous Alice Waters, who is... I've interviewed a lot for over the course of time, and I, you know, when I first came to California, my palate was waking up in so many ways, and you know, was the California food movement had morphed into the organic food movement, and there was a real interest in learning about what we were actually eating and what was going into our what we were growing and eating, and Alice Waters was on the forefront of that, and I interviewed her plenty of times. And, you know, she's a maddening interview, and she is unwavering. And as Marion Cunningham said, certainly makes you feel like you're not doing it right. And I think that that's probably true. But I have never come across somebody who was whose hand is on the rudder so firmly in this business. And it always impressed me that she hadn't. There's not like Chez Panisse Las Vegas. She doesn't have a line of cookware out. She's not showing up to be a judge on Top Chef Masters. You know, that she just does what she does, which is. Right now, she's very invested in making sure that school children eat good food and that there are gardens in schools and that her restaurant continues to serve really good food sourced by farmers. And that seems to me to be a pretty amazing thing to have done for 30 plus years without wavering. So I got a good education from Alice Waters about, you know, about certain things and about politics. And, you know, it's been interesting to watch people love and hate her as well, like they do Rachel Ray.
Do you remember the first time you saw Alice Waters?
I do. You know, I had gone to eat in Chez Panisse, and of course there was a huge buildup. And those of you who have eaten there, it's a very understated place. This whole craftsman, you know, and you get a plate and there's lamb, and then you think, okay, well, am I missing something? You know, and then you start to taste and understand where the lamb comes from. And you're like, and this is an orange. This is a tangerine, and I kind of looked around for like, really, this tangerine is my moment. And but it was, you know, you start to taste it and you start to understand where it came from, and that's kind of where the alchemy comes in of that restaurant. But she swoops in. I heard somebody say Alice is here, and she swoops in, and she was looking for a flashlight for Johnny Apple. This was way before I ever thought I would ever work at the Times. And here comes Johnny Apple, who was the late great food writer and bureau chief and Pulitzer Prize winner and larger-than-life character, and he comes walking in, and he was in town to stay with her, and that's the first time that I saw them, and I was my head turned at Johnny Apple, but now with time I realize that I should have swiveled as hard for Alice Waters.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about kitchen wisdom and how great cooks can teach us big life lessons. We're speaking with Kim Severson, food writer at the New York Times and author of the new memoir, Spoon Fed, How Eight Cooks Saved My Life. One of those eight cooks joins us now. With me from Berkeley, California, is Alice Waters, famed chef and pioneer of the sustainable fresh food movement. She is out with a new cookbook, In the Green Kitchen, Techniques to Learn by Heart. Welcome, Alice Waters. Nice to have you.
Well, thank you.
I remember first interviewing you about 10 years ago, and I still remember that I asked you why you love cooking. Tell us the story again, at the heart of it, what cooking means to you.
Well, it's just an everyday, beautiful experience in my life. It's kind of a ritual. It's become a way of living that I wake up in the morning and make my tea and toast my bread and spread it with avocado and just sit down at the table, and it grounds me in a way that nothing else does.
What do you think about America's food and eating trends today, Alice?
You can only imagine. Just sort of 24 hours, nonstop eating is just so confusing to one's life when you just grab it and do it on the run. You just don't have the pleasure of a moment in time, that particular season. The fast foods have just seem omnipresent in a narrow, very narrow vein. And so you don't have the pleasure of eating fava beans and peas and all those beautiful things that come just at this moment in time. You're eating sort of second-rate fruits and vegetables all year long. And so when the really good thing comes around, you don't have it. So it's really important that we kind of come back to our senses and begin to taste and be connected with our family and friends around the table. What better way to sort of enjoy each other's company than to cook together and sit down and eat it?
And what do you think is the best way to do that? What's the process of getting back to that, of the slow food movement of which you speak?
Well, I think the best way, of course, I would love to have these ideas taught in school, but until that happens, I think the best way is to go to the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. Because that's where you meet the people who actually produce that food, and you can talk to them a little bit and ask questions about it, and it has a life and vitality, a kind of beauty to it that I find is irresistible. And you meet your friends there and you become engaged. Now, you might have a little opportunity to have a garden, and that's another great way to bring yourself into the experience of real food. And when you have good tasting food like that, you hardly have to do a thing to it.
I ask this question because of the themes contained in Kim Severson's book about the women cooks who taught her important lessons about life. Do you, not to leave men out, but do you see that women have a unique connection to food and its nurture of the soul?
I do, in a way. I mean, just because they are the ones that bear the children, and they need to feed the children. And it's in their genes to do so. But it doesn't mean that men are less able to do that. And I have found that men are becoming involved in, you know, just all of the care of children, and I see them very often at the farmers market with their kids, and it's a very good sign that men are cooking not just to be the heads of fancy French restaurants around mm-hmm. the world, mm-hmm. but because they are finding the satisfaction and the pleasure of cooking for their families.
Alice Waters, let me welcome a caller, a listener into our conversation. Kathy is on the line from Fort Myers, Florida. She'd like to join. Kathy, welcome to the program with Kim Severson and Alice Waters.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I live about 30 miles from a town called Immokalee, and 90% of the nation's winter tomatoes are grown around this community. Once a month, I started Project Fresh Market, where I go and purchase a couple hundred dollars worth of fresh produce, bring it to our church, sell it, and send the proceeds back to the farm workers. So I've been known by my friends and family as a food enabler. And yesterday, after Fresh Market, I came home with my eggplants and my yellow squash and my zucchini and my tomatoes. And we just gather around the kitchen and we saute and we roast and we throw in cheese and we drink wine. And yet, and the farm workers are receiving the benefit. So I guess it's kind of a question. I see eating as a holy act, a sacred act. And how can we embrace around the table those people who pick our food and grow our food, some of the poorest of the poor? So it's kind of it's a question.
Kathy, thank you. Alice Waters, would you respond?
This is really the work of the slow food movement, is to make sure that you're buying food that not only tastes good, but that is pure, free of herbicides and pesticides. And then thirdly, and most importantly in this country, I think we've understood a little bit about taste and about sustainability, but we haven't really understood about what it takes to grow that food. And that's the fair part. And I think we need to put an emphasis on that, that we want to go out and see how it's grown and what the conditions are, because the people who grow it need to make the proper wage and live under the proper conditions. And there's no compromise there. That's I consider the farmers precious. And I can't imagine not supporting, buying food from people who don't care about the people who work for them.
Here's another call from Chris, who's in Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Chris. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. My name is Chris. One thing you guys are talking about that I find incredible is reconnecting people with each other. One way that I've been doing that and also kind of expanding a little bit more, reconnecting ourselves with nature, is going out as a group of friends or alone and collecting wild edible plants and coming home and cooking them together with my friends. It's been a really great thing, because if you can't get too close to a farmer's market, or if you don't have space for a garden, all you need is a field guide or a teacher, and you can go out and collect your own wild edible plants, and right now is a great season to do that.
Chris, thank you very much. Alice Waters, that's some of what you're trying to do with the Chez Panisse Foundation, yes?
Absolutely. But the foraging part has been very important to us, for probably since the beginning. 35 years ago, we were out collecting wild mushrooms. But while we were there, we sort of were picking the little watercress and the miner's lettuce, and then we started picking the blossoms off the plum trees, and we just made some plum blossom ice cream. But it's endless, the food that it just grows in the wild, and then even what grows in the city. In people's backyards, it's never used. There's a group here in Oakland that goes around the neighborhoods and offers to pick the fruit, to make something of it, and to offer it back to the family that has the tree. And it's such a great idea to gather that free food, if you will, and the best tasting food. Because it's just sort of, when it's grown in the wild, it's just, it has to survive on its own. It has a kind of flavor that is unlike anything else, I think.
It is a delight to speak with you again, Alice Waters. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Love Kim's book.
Thanks, Alice.
Beautiful. Bye.
Alice Waters, chef and proprietor of the famous Chez Panisse restaurant in Berkeley, California, one of the great culinary experiences, founder of the Chez Panisse Foundation, which supports the integration of gardening and cooking and the sharing of a daily school lunch into America's public school curriculum. Kim Severson, back to your book. Tell us how these eight women that you profile in the book, Alice Waters being one of them, how did they change how you see food?
Yeah, I think one thing they did, perhaps the most important thing they did, was underline feelings I had all along and give me the confidence to trust what I think is good about the plate and about the kitchen. And also, you know, older women, we have, you know, people influence us along the way, and we don't even see it when it's happening. And I think it's so important to think about who you might be influencing with a few words of encouragement or sharing what you know in the kitchen or with whatever skill or craft you have, and to really honor and recognize the people who, even just with a few words on a day that's like the lousiest day ever, give you the encouragement to keep going. And those little magic guides throughout our life are really worth recognizing, because I think that, you know, comes a time when we all need to pass it on and help the next generation coming up. So I love that cycle, and these women were really really key to teaching me what I needed to know. And luckily it was all about food, so that was the big bonus.
You're a food writer for the New York Times since 2004. You know, we think of a food writer or food critic as having a glamorous life of fancy restaurants and expense accounts. And you write that one of the things that you try to do with your food writing for the Times is to bring in a cultural and economic and social political issue as it relates to the plate. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of it is that I'm just I'm a basic news reporter. I just like to go out and gather information and pass it on. And I think any story, you could tell any story from the plate. You certainly could tell the story of the floods in New Orleans from the plate. You could tell the story about what's happening in Afghanistan, from what's happening to how people have had to change how they cook, even how the soldiers have to eat and how we feed soldiers. There's all kinds of stories to be told through food. And I think it's economic stories, it's cultural stories, it's romance. It's a lot more than just recipes, although the recipe part of my job is probably the really greatest part when I get to just cook something or find somebody who gives me a good recipe. But I think it's food is so much broader in our culture now, and I think there's lots of opportunities to look into to race, to gender, to economics through what we're cooking.
Back to the phones now to Louise, who's in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Louise. Thanks for waiting, and welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. One thing that hasn't been mentioned yet is how fast people are eating, mm-hmm. Just in terms of the time that they're eating. My dad was raised by my grandmother, who really got him to take time with every mouthful and chew it so many chews. And I do think that influences how our health is impacted by the nutrients that we're trying to take in, and it actually helps us taste the food better. Hmm. So when I think about so many people racing around, grabbing something, if you look at how quickly it's gone before you've really had time to enjoy it, I think it's, you know, one, you're missing the enjoyment of it, but you're also missing the health impact of really getting those nutrients processed before they hit the lower parts of our digestive system to be absorbed.
That's a good point, Louise. Thank you. Kim Severson?
I do think eating too fast is a problem. It's certainly a problem in my life. I work in Midtown Manhattan, and, you know, we do everything faster. In fact, I was just thinking, what could I find? What food could I find foraging around in Midtown? And I think it's just going to be a dirty water hot dog. Okay. But, you know, it is a problem. And so I have a 2-year-old, and we try to sit down for breakfast and, when I can, dinner. And the time that she's able to sit at the table is increasing and increasing, and it just gets so much more fun the longer she can sit there. And sitting there and having to focus on whether this kid's going to, you know, choke to death on whatever they're eating or, you know, dump the spaghetti off the side of the table, you just really have to focus on the moment and on eating. And I found that it's really changed my perspective on just being there at the moment. You know, we don't have our BlackBerries and our iPhones at the table, and we are very careful about making sure that there's that moment, as it's really hard to do. You know, I think life's busy and life's fast, and we're used to eating in front of the TV. Marion Cunningham used to say, it's like we're living in motels. We're cooking things in the microwave and eating in front of a TV, and it just breaks my heart.
Here's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org, posted by Lynn Francois. She says, I loved Kim's comment that her mother's kitchen was her office. I consider myself the family CEO, CFO. I look at cooking and raising family as much as a profession as when I was teaching or a corporate paralegal. My daughters all know how to cook, and they take pride in doing so. My son is just getting good at it, and he won't leave for college without knowing how to do it well also. The graduation gift for all of my children is a copy of the Fanny Farmer Cookbook. Thanks, Lynn, very
great.
Much.
That's
In terrific. Our last minute here, Kim Severson, tell us one of your most memorable experiences eating with one of the women in your book.
Well, you know, Leah Chase brought me out a plate of hot fried chicken, and it was a day when she didn't have to cook. She had a bad leg. She was in the kitchen trying to get, I think, the plasters to come finish something. And she's like, no, you got to just sit down and eat. It's your work and sit down. And she brought me out some fried chicken and some red beans and rice. And I thought, this woman is living because she needs to feed other people. And I was honored to sit and take that food from her and eat it. And, you know, that's just, I mean, that's one of 100 stories I could tell you about people giving me a taste of food and that bond between us, that friendship that grew, and the honor and the respect of all the years of her work that went into serving me that plate. It was an honor to eat that fried chicken.
Kim Severson is food writer for the New York Times. Since 2004, she's a 4-time winner of the James Beard Award for food writing. Her new book is called Spoonfed: How 8 Cooks Saved My Life. To read an excerpt of the book, go to our website at onpointradio.org. Kim, thank you very much for a delightful hour.
That was a great hour. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.